Ratjev, and it's based on these papers. And Ratjev is now joined me with in Odense, where I'm now. It's well, it's University of Southern Denmark. So the point is that we have observed magnetic fields in galaxies and galaxy clusters with a strength around microgauss. Well, so initially people were believing that these kind of magnetic fields could be generated from some kind of seeds, like very weak magnetic fields, which could come from moving charges around in the galaxies and galaxy structures. So this is called the galactic dynamo. But the coherence length of such magnetic fields created from the galactic dynamo would be a bit too short. So then, by turbulent processes in the galactic medium, one believed that somehow the coherent length of the magnetic fields could be increased by some kind of turbulent processes. So one problem with this idea of increasing the coherence lengths of the magnetic fields from these turbulent processes is that that you would need a large amount of magnetic helicity for this kind of process to work. So if you don't want to go there, then instead one could think that the magnetic fields, the seeds are created by some phase transitions in the early universe, but after the end of inflation. But then the problem with that is that the coherence length would be too small to explain the magnetic fields that has been observed on the kiloparsec scale, because any magnetic fields which is created in a causal process in the simulate universe, that means after inflation, would have a coherence length which is smaller than the horizon scale at that time, and that is a rather small scale, so it would actually create a too small magnetic field. But anyway, so there is this possibility of increasing the coherence length of the magnetic field in some kind of turbulent process. However, more recently, it has been claimed that there is an observation of a lower bound on the strength of magnetic field in the extragalactic scales, so on scales larger than galaxy clusters. So that is a lower bound on about femtogauss. So the limit on this comes from this kind of lower bound comes from observation of blazars, which are kind of compact stellar-like objects which emit TV scale gamma rays. And these gamma rays, they interact with the diffuse background radiation in the extragalactic media and creates electron-positron pairs, which then again can interact with the cosmic microwave background and produce GeV scale gamma rays. So, well, if there is a magnetic field on extragalactic scales, the positron-electron pairs will be bent in this magnetic field, and you will somehow see that these GeV gamma rays will not come exactly from the blazar, but a little bit around it. And this is apparently what one sees. So that seems to be an indication that there is some non-vanishing magnetic field on extragalactic scales. So the Well, so the problem with that is, of course, that it's very hard to see how one can produce magnetic fields on extragalactic scales by moving charges around in galaxy and galaxy structures or clusters. So, so the fact that one sees well a non-vanishing or a lower bound on the strength of the magnetic field or cosmological magnetic fields on such large scales seems to be an indication that the magnetic field has a primordial origin. So that is that the magnetic fields are generated by something like inflation, where we anyway need to generate correlate. Well, okay, it's known, of course, that inflation has this nice properties of generating coherences on very large scales, because this is exactly how inflation solves the horizon problem of the standard Big Bang model, right? So it's very natural to look at inflation for generating something that is a coherent on very large scales and extragalactic scales. So if you believe in this, this is a very strong indication that the existence of the cosmological magnetic fields has something to do with inflation. There is also an upper bound on the magnetic fields generated from inflation, which comes from their effect on CMB, because if you have a magnetic field from inflation, they will induce a polarization in the CMB, and that gives you an upper bound, which is of order nanogauss. So you know, well, so if you trust this, you somehow know that there are cosmological magnetic fields generated from inflation with a strength somewhere in between nanogauss and femtogauss. So this is the challenge to find a mechanism during inflation which produce magnetic fields in this range, okay?
Right. You observe some puffing up in the size of the parent source of the electrons.
Right.
It sounds like it would give you a measurement of the magnetic field, not just an estimate of the magnetic field, not just the lower bound. What do they call it, the lower bound?
I suppose that's what. I suppose that's the.
Oh, it depends on the coherence length of the field also.
Well, that's possible, yeah. So, I mean, but anyway, I mean, they see some absence of GeV photons from the blazer, right? And that they need to explain by having a magnetic field which is at least this strength. That's at least how they give the result. Yeah. So I'm not too much into the details of that actually. But,
Okay, it's not that they observe.
They see an absence.
Disk of secondaries around the blazar, so they see fewer photons.
Right.
The blazar than they
right.
Seen.
Right. That's the observation.
I think Avery had the criticism of this one. I don't remember what it was.
Here's another mechanism.
But he was saying that this bound wasn't correct.
Well, there has been some. I mean, okay. So this is a very new kind of technique. And there are different kind of, it's being discussed in the literature. So one thing which has been discussed is whether it would be possible to make up a magnetic field like this by having very strong sources from astrophysical sources. That seems kind of unlikely, but it's not impossible probably. And then there are some technical discussions about, whether it should be 10 to the minus 15, and then there are some, more conservative bounds, but they are still in the range of 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 17 lower bounds. So, So the point is just whether you can generate from inflation magnetic fields, basically, with a field strength in this order. And this has some history, which goes all the way back to Turner and Widerøe, who considered this first, I think. So the idea is that if you have just the ordinary Maxwell's equations in FRW spacetime, they are conformal. That means that the electromagnetic field doesn't feel the expansion of the spacetime, or the scale factor drops out of the equations of motions. So that means that the mechanism that amplifies the perturbations of, say, a scalar field and all that, which we are used to from inflation, doesn't work for the electromagnetic field in this simplest form. So in order to have an enhancement or an amplification of fluctuations of the magnetic field, you will need to break this in conformal invariance in some way. And there are different ways of doing it, but generally you need to couple the electromagnetic field to some other fields which is non which is coupled to gravity in a way that breaks the conformal invariance. So there are different general ways to do that. You could introduce a coupling in terms in front of the field strength. Or the kinetic term for the gauge field, which depends on time during inflation, or which it could be the inflaton field, so it depends on the inflaton field as it rolls. You could also consider some kind of coupling to gravity like this. So of course, if you really think of this as the inflaton, these two things are equivalent because the curvature scalar will depend on the inflaton, right? It will depend on the Hubble scale, which is a function of the inflaton as it rolls. So, sorry?
In FRW,
right?
But more generically, if you put equations on the second one, you're going to have all the compact.
No, I mean, those two things are equivalent, right? If, I mean, there's no difference, right? I mean, this is just the Hubble rate. The Hubble rate is a function of the inflaton as it rolls, right? Sorry? Right, so it's in FRW, it's just the Hubble rate, right? Well, okay, I think you may be thinking of something else, which I will mention in two seconds. So there's also the possibility of a coupling having an axial coupling of this sort. So people have checked this, and one has found that there are constraints from back reaction. And also last non-Gaussianities in the CMB, which actually prohibit you from generating the magnetic fields at the order that I mentioned, from having a coupling like this. So then you could also kind of have a mass term, and you could also have, for instance, that this mass could be proportional to R again. Maybe that's what you think of. If you do that, you would need to have a negative mass squared term to have the generation of large magnetic fields, or to have the magnetic fields amplified during inflation. However, if you try to generate a mass like this with a kind of Higgs mechanism, that will lead to Gauss degrees of freedom for your scalar field, and that's clearly not very attractive. So also this kind of model is kind of not very very attractive to work with. So that leaves us basically with the first kind of model as the, at this point, at, or at this level, as the only viable model for trying to do this kind of things, right? Or to generate magnetic fields with the magnitude that we are interested in during inflation. So So that, then let me just try to summarize how that works. So you have an action of this type where you have the electromagnetic field and it's coupling to the inflaton. Okay, let's just take it to be the inflaton phi. And then the potential and the kinetic term for the scalar field phi or the inflaton. And then you can choose a gauge. And it turns out to be convenient to choose the Coulomb gauge. And then you can write down the action for the vector potential. And then, of course, the magnetic field is related to the vector potential. So then you can go to to Fourier space, of course, in the usual way, and you can quantize your electromagnetic field or your vector potential in the usual way by doing a mode expansion and introduce canonic commutation relations. What we would be interested in is in the power spectrum of the magnetic field, because that's basically what one measures when one measures the magnetic fields. And that is defined through the two-point function in the usual way. So the power spectrum is related to the two-point function of the magnetic fields, which can then, of course, be computed from the Fourier modes of the vector field. So then it reduces to solve the equations of motion for the Fourier mode of the vector field. To do that, it turns out to be convenient to introduce what we call a pump field, which is just related to this coupling, which appears in front of the kinetic term for the vector field. Then you can do a canonical, define a canonically normalized vector field, which is which has a standard kinetic term, which is related to the vector potential through the pump field. And then the action for this canonically normalized vector field takes a very standard form, where now the time dependence or the dependence on the background enters through this pump field, and it appears as a mass term for this canonically normalized vector field. So this is very similar to the kind of things that we're used to in inflation, where this is basically the same equations as that for a scalar field with a time-dependent mass term, right? So then one can go on and solve this equation with some ansatz for the time dependence of this coupling. So if tau is conformal time, one can take as an ansatz that this coupling grows with the conformal time as some power. Fix the initial vacuum to be the usual Bunce-Davis vacuum from the quantum fluctuations of the field. And one gets the usual solution, which is some Hankel functions with an index that depends on the time dependence of the coupling, okay? So then one can find that the power spectrum of the magnetic fields are given in terms of these Hankel functions, where the index of the Hankel functions now depends on this general parameterization of the coupling. So so quite generally, you get a magnetic power spectrum with a spectral tilt that depends on this N. So it's you have 1/2 N, so that's like appearing here, and then there is also k to the 5 here and k to the 3 here. So it turns out that the spectral index of the power spectrum is given by 4 minus 2n. So that means that a flat spectrum or a scale invariant spectrum corresponds to n equal 2. So that's a simple power law for this coupling. And of course, if you would have a non-flat spectrum, then you would end up having a large back reaction from either UV or IR modes, okay? So in order to avoid back reaction problems in this model from the amplification of the quantum fluctuations, you will need that this spectral index is zero, or that the spectrum is flat, and that this this power law behavior of this coupling is described by n equal 2. And then one can check that if one takes a reasonable scale for the Hubble scale during inflation, that means like some kind of the usual inflationary scale in a single field inflationary model, and with n equal 2, then one, it turns out that one can generate nano Gauss magnetic fields on the megaparsec scales, right? I don't expect this to. So here, no, it doesn't change. I mean, because, So here I'm just using the background behavior of the inflaton, and the effect of what you would. That would then be the fluctuations of the inflaton field would be a very small correction on top of this, right? So what you need to have the amplification of the magnetic field is that you have the role of the inflaton that gives you a time dependence, that's your clock, and then you need the coupling to depend on the inflaton field in such a way that the time dependence is this simple, where did we have it? This simple power law dependence of time, okay? So,
I want to know how the metric mixes with the electric field, the vector degrees.
So you're thinking about vector perturbations of the metric? So those decay, right?
Which I guess maybe that's in the back of my mind why I'm a little bit.
Right, so this is more like an isocurvature field, right? Okay. So this is a subdominant field during inflation, so I'm assuming that it doesn't back react on the geometry. The enhancement comes from having this non-minimal coupling. Well, I have to go even one more way. This non-minimal coupling here, right? So if this coupling was trivial, I wouldn't have any enhancement. The magnetic fields would live in flat space, right? So they don't.
The other thing is that the back reaction on metric is second order, because the energy momentum tensor is second order.
Right.
Magnetic field.
Yeah, so I think.
So they wouldn't mix at the linear level.
Right, so that's the same as saying that the magnetic field is subdominant, right? So it's like an isocurvature field. So it doesn't back. Well, yeah. So there's.
Sorry, so the metric is flat in this calculation?
Sorry?
Is the metric flat in this calculation?
So flat spatially, right? Yeah, so what you. It's an,
but it is evolving.
There is a scale factor, of course. I mean, it's an FRW space time, right? Where the scale factor is evolving exponentially. So the reason that, what I meant by flat is that if this coupling is constant, then the equation of motions for the electromagnetic field is conformal. So that means that the scale factor drops out of the equation of motion. So then they live in an effectively flat, they don't feel the curvature of space time, or they don't feel the expansion of space.
There's no vector for degrees of freedom in the metric. So
what?
There's no.
What?
There are no dynamical vectors in the metric.
What do we mean? There are vector perturbations, of course, with the metric.
But they're not dynamical on what they get. They just get eliminated as auxiliary fields.
No, they.
Kind of saying, like, when you introduce a scalar field, then the thing usually follows, like, something like Zeta.
There's no ambiguity. There's only one scalar degree of freedom.
Right.
And so
choose different gauges.
No, there are one scalar degree of freedom, but there are also, I mean, there's one true scalar degree of freedom, which is basically the trace of the network, right? And then there is a vector degrees of freedom, and then there are tensor, true tensor degrees of freedom. So the tensor ones are the gravitational waves, right? There are tensor fluctuations of the metric that which corresponds basically to gravitational waves, and those we hope even to, I mean, those are also amplified during inflation, and we hope to measure them, even with Planck, right? So we hope to be able to see primordial gravitational waves. So vector modes are not amplified, they decay, okay? So we don't expect to see the effect of the vector fluctuations of the metric from inflation. Okay.
It's not that they decay, it's just they don't exist as physical.
There's a gauge.
Right, once there's a gauge field, it's dynamical, but it's unambiguous what the vector degree of freedom is.
There are vector fluctuations of the metric. They are just not amplified, okay? So they're not important usually. I mean, that's why you don't hear about them. I mean, but this is not vector fluctuations of the metric. These are, a gauge field that we have added, and which we assume doesn't contribute to the energy momentum tensor. So they don't contribute to the fluctuations of the metric. So they're like an isocurvature field. The fluctuations get amplified because of this non-minimal coupling that we add by hand. Unsatisfied?
I'm a few that there's only two dynamical degrees of freedom, the scalar and vector perturbation determined by constraints, but nevertheless, it's true. Matt, this is an example. Matt has in mind the example where you go towards the center limit. I agree with you that the scalar perturbations of the curvature are determined by the scalar perturbation of the scalar field. And it's just like in that case, physically, if you check the perturbation of the scalar field, you get one answer, and then you can ask whether the perturbations of the curvature might be more physically relevant than there. So that is a different, one goes to zero.
So what I have look at the famous example of the ekpyrotic universe, right?
Right?
If you do a test field, you see you get a scale invariant spectrum, but then if you realize that the correct thing to calculate is the power spectrum of zeta and not the test field, you get a different answer. I just wanted to know if this
right,
a rigorous argument that said the test field gives you the right answer. That's all it was.
No, but this is because that's because in that case we're really interested in the fluctuation of the metric, right? So we have a test scalar field, and we need to figure out how that test scalar field is mapped to metric perturbations. Okay, here we are not interested really in the metric perturbations. We are really interested in the fluctuations of this test scalar field itself. Right? I mean, we are just interested in producing excitations of this test scalar field. Right?
When you're talking about a vector field, every field is a test field.
So are we doing gauge event? We're doing gauge event perturbation theory, right? So I mean, we should all agree on that.
Right.
I mean, we will be if we're doing gauge event perturbation. We must all be doing that.
I guess with scalars, there can you have more than one. So if you have like a test scalar, but which one is certain zeta.
But we're not talking about we will talk about scalar perturbations, but we're not yet talking about scalar perturbations. We're just talking about, I mean, think of it as an isocurvature field. Think of it as, but now the isocurvature field is just a vector field. Now we're just thinking of how you are producing, you know, excitations of that isocurvature field. That's it. And at some point, you might be interested in figuring out which kind of imprint on the curvature perturbation this isocurvature field could leave. But that's a second step, okay? We are not there yet. But to have a non-vanishing power spectrum of magnetic fields, you need to, in the first instance, create excitations of the magnetic field. And this is the vector field that we're discussing, and that is, you can think of it as an isocurvature field during inflation. So you don't need to think about metric perturbations at this level because you can ignore the effect on the metric of this, the back reaction of these fluctuations in the metric at this point.
Could I ask about
right.
About the argument for it being scale invariant.
Right.
Just more detail, the idea that I'm trying to get a sense of what the inputs are and then what the outputs are and what are the error bars. So you're saying if you want to get more than 10 to the minus 15 Gauss on
right.
intergalactic scales,
right.
and then if you tilt it too much to the red or blue, it'll have right. too much energy density on large scales.
Right. Right.
It sounds like that would be a pretty weak bound on the red sun.
On what?
On the red side.
Well, no, it's just because, I mean, well, it's just because you're integrating up the modes, right? And you don't want simply that the total energy density stored in the magnetic field back reacts on the inflation.
Right.
So that's the constraint. There is, I mean, it doesn't have to be exactly two, but I don't remember the exact, but there, of course, it could be 2 points something. I don't know what happened. I mean, there is a constraint, of course,
on
back reaction.
Do you think delta N is less than delta index is less than one? Error bar index is less than
plus minus one? Sorry, if I believe that NB, the spectral index of the magnetic field.
Do you think this argument demands that the spectral index be closer to, that the error bar on the spectral index is less than one?
I think it is.
But it also depends on the length of the information.
Well, now we're assuming basically, I mean, even if you assume 60 EFOs of inflation, I think it's still true. Okay, so.
In the previous slide, why does the strength of the magnetic field depend only on the inflation scale? Doesn't it also depend on the coupling with the pi field?
The coupling, what? Why does it depend only? Why did we go? Why does it depend only on what? On the inflationary scale?
Yeah.
And not on what?
I think that it should also depend on how strong it couples with the pi.
It depends on the time dependence in the coupling, not on the absolute strength.
And that time dependence is fixed here.
Well, so the time dependence is fixed by n, right? That's what we are constrained. And also, you know, at the end of inflation, lambda has to be 1 because you have to recover ordinary electromagnetism at the end of inflation, right? So if you look at the action, you know that this is 1 today, right? So you need, that at the end of inflation, lambda is 1. So then you have pretty much everything fixed in your model by the parameter n. So in fact, this is exactly related to this strong coupling problem. So, I mean, this sounded all too good to be true, right? So there is, of course, a problem. So the problem is, of course, you also need to add the coupling to the fermions, right, in the standard model. And if you do that, you will see that when you go into a canonical vector field, then you will end up having the coupling, the non-minimal coupling here, rescaling the electric charge. So the physical charge will be proportional to 1/√ of this dynamical coupling.
So are we still talking about inflation, or this is after inflation?
So now we're talking about during inflation, right?
But then, if you have a standard model for inflation.
What do you mean we have them or not? I mean, do you mean if there are if there are particles around during inflation? Or if you, I mean, clearly they're there in my Lagrangian, right? But of course they're not, I mean, so the whole question is that, okay, let me just finish. So of course they're there in Lagrangian. So at this point, I should include them in my Lagrangian, of course. And the physical coupling will then be given by...
We don't know that they're there. If there is, there could be a strong coupling phase transition, and then you might have other degrees of freedom that get at high energies. Like you have quarks, say at high energies, at low energies, you have other like hadrons. So there is no guarantee that at low energies you see some fermions, you're going to see the same fermions at high energies. There could be some other things.
Right. I mean, they will be contained in your model somehow, right? And so
well, I mean, if there are fundamental particles, but if there
right.
are not fundamental particles, then they wouldn't be. There would be some other degrees of freedom.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, but then one would, well, that could be that would be a possible avenue for a solution to the problem I'm going to outline for you now. But if you think that there are fundamental fermions present which couple electromagnetically, then their charge will scale, their physical charge will change inversely as a square root of this coupling when you go into the canonical normalized field. And this means that since the coupling goes like the scale factor to some power n, this means that the physical charge will decrease during inflation, right? Quite fast. And since we know that this coupling should be 1 at the end of inflation to recover the ordinary case, this means that when we go a little bit backwards into the phase of inflation, this electric coupling becomes very large, okay? So this means that you enter into some kind of a strongly coupled regime. So that also means that even though you don't have maybe charged particles around during inflation because they're diluted away by the inflationary phase itself, it means that you don't have control of the quantum fluctuations of these fields during inflation and, so you don't have any control of your on your predictions from inflation, basically, right? So so this is called the strong coupling problem, and it was pointed out by these people some years ago. This seems to be a very hard problem for this kind of models. But as I just said, that I mean, we seem to have this indication that these magnetic fields on extragalactic scales are there, with at least femtogauss strength. We also saw that it's very hard to find working models that can generate sufficiently large magnetic fields from inflation, and this model seems to be one of the only ones that can actually do it. So it's still interesting to think about this model, okay? So then one runs into this problem with this strong coupling, and at this point, of course, one could kind of just give up or try to think about solutions for this strong coupling problem. Okay, so there is no real solution for this. There are people who have been speculating about solutions, but there is no real solution. Okay,
what goes wrong? Maybe the naivest thing you could do is introduce a second coupling for the fermions and hope that you could fix things up that way.
Well,
do you know what goes wrong?
So at this point, I think that. Well, most of the proposed speculations for solving this problem involves breaking the gauge invariance of the model in some way or another, okay? And then there's a discussion of doing that in a controlled or consistent way, whether you can do that or not, right? So this is a hard problem, okay? There is not any known good solution for this problem, okay? Still, okay, you can take a phenomenological approach and you can say that we do observe these large-scale magnetic fields. This is one of the few models that we know of that can actually do it during inflation, and you can try to understand the phenomenology of it and keep in the back mind that there is this unresolved problem that is very interesting. Okay. So if there is a way to test the model phenomenologically. Then, of course, if we could rule it out phenomenologically, then we wouldn't need to think more about this, okay? So this is a little bit the approach or the kind of philosophy I will take here. I will think, okay, I don't have any good solution for this problem for you to present, okay? So instead, I will see if there is a way that we could phenomenologically exclude this model, okay? Because then, okay, clearly we can forget about this problem, right? So that comes back to the issue of non-Gaussianity, okay? So if you stare at the Lagrangian here, you see you have a direct coupling of the magnetic field with the inflaton. So that kind of suggests that the perturbations of the inflaton and the magnetic fields will be correlated during inflation, okay? So That implies that you will have a non-vanishing correlation function where you have one power of the curvature perturbation, which is related to the perturbations of the interaction field, and two powers of the magnetic field. Okay. So that is one phenomenological implication of a model like that. So the challenge is to calculate this. Okay. So now let me just review a little bit of non-Gaussianity. Time is flying a bit faster. We had a lot of discussion. So let me be very quick on this then. Okay, so you have, from single field slow roll inflation, you also have a tiny bit of non-Gaussianity. Well, why do I say a tiny bit? Okay, because in single field slow roll inflation, you need the potential to be very flat to have inflation. To have a potential which is very flat means essentially that you have to have a small self-coupling of the inflaton. So that means you have to have weak self-interactions. And you know that a free field is Gaussian, so that means that the non-Gaussian corrections are suppressed by the smallness of this self-interaction of the inflaton. Okay. Nevertheless, they're there. So you can and one diagnosis of non-Gaussianity is of course the three-point function, which should be non-vanishing if there is non-Gaussianity, and vanishing if in the Gaussian case, of course. Then the usual thing to do is to introduce an FNL parameter, which is the three-point correlation function divided by two powers of the power spectrum. So that is some dimensionless number which characterizes for you the level of non-Gaussianity. Okay. So you could introduce a tau NL, which is the same thing just for the four-point function. Okay. So then you can go on and calculate these things, okay? So let me just review quickly a very nice calculation basically Maldacena, which is the three-point function in the squeeze limit. That is when the momenta of one of the Fourier modes is much smaller than the other two. That means that you have a very long labeling fluctuations, and then you have two short wavelength modes sitting on the top of this long wavelength perturbation. Okay, so then from the point of view of these two short wavelength modes, this long wavelength perturbation is just a change of the background. So you can calculate the two-point function of the short wavelength modes on the background of the long wavelength mode, and then correlate it with the long wavelength mode to get the three-point function in the squeeze limit. Okay, and if you do that, you get the Maldacena consistency relation, where you see that the three-point function is given by is suppressed by the spectral the spectral index. Okay, so NS minus one is of order the slow roll parameter times two powers of the power spectrum. Okay, so this is like a local non-Gaussianity which can be obtained from a usual field redefinition of this type. Okay, so it's a very naive way of parametrizing non-linearity in the perturbations. Okay, you just say that at second order. The perturbation is proportional to the linear perturbation squared times some nonlinear parameter FNL. Okay, and this Maldacena consistency relation will tell you that the local FNL in the squeezed limit is this order epsilon. Okay, and of course similarly you could do that for the four-point function. I will skip over that because we have a little bit. So let me skip all this because of the time. And then just tell you that then in order to parameterize the non-Gaussianity from the magnetic fields, we could of course follow a similar strategy and introduce a new non-linearity parameter called BNL, okay? So the logic is very simple. We go back to this correlation function we were interested in. We were interested in to find the non-Gaussian correlation of the magnetic field with the curvature perturbation. We of course want to parameterize it in a way that we are familiar with, so we want to introduce a BNL parameter, which is similar to the FNL, but now for this three-point function. So we introduce the cross-correlation bi-spectrum between the magnetic fields and the curvature perturbation. And then we define a BNL to be the relation between this cross-correlation bi-spectrum and the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation and the magnetic field power spectrum, okay?
Is there a heuristic argument to understand why this is the shape of the dominant image?
Good point. So it will not be, so the local shape will not be the dominant one. But still we can use this parameterization, okay? So then BNL would just not be a constant, but it will be some function of Fourier modes, okay? But of course, if BNL is momentum independent, it will be of the local form, and a momentum independent BNL will follow from a field redefinition of this type, okay? So, I mean, this is very similar. It follows directly in a similar fashion as FNL by showing you how the curvature perturbation induces nonlinearity in the magnetic field. Okay. I put the comparison there actually. So then you can look at two interesting limits. Okay. So of course, first we will think about the squeeze limit. Just by analogy with the Maldacena case, okay. So in that case, I want to show to you, if I have the time, that you have a magnetic consistency relation very much like the Maldacena consistency relation, although the derivation of it is a little bit different, okay. Actually, quite a lot different, but still very simple, okay. From this magnetic consistency relation, you get that your correlation function is proportional to the spectral index of the magnetic field minus 4 times the power spectrum of the curvature perturbation and the power spectrum of the magnetic field. So that means that you get a BNL local in the squeeze limit, which is the spectral index of the magnetic field minus 4. Okay. So the scale in the scale invariant case, NB, or the spectral index of the magnetic field, is zero. So in this in the scale invariant case, you get a BNL local which is minus 4. Okay. And that is to compare again with the Maldacena consistency relation, where you get the slow roll suppressed FNL. Okay. So then there is the other interesting shape, which is the flattened shape, which is where the non-Gaussian energy is maximized, okay? So that is when the wave, the momentum mode corresponding to the curvature perturbation is maximal. You have a flattened triangle where the long side of the triangle is the mode of the curvature perturbation, the correlation function.
I have heard this question, right. The curvature perturbation comes from the fluctuation of the field.
Right.
And the magnetic field comes from the fluctuation of the ether, right?
Right.
They're totally, at the basic level, they're like different fields, so you wouldn't imagine there to be correlations between those two fluctuations, right?
I didn't understand your question. I mean, you would, in fact, you would in fact expect there to be correlation because you introduced by hand a direct coupling between the inflaton and the electromagnetic field, right?
So
that is like a
back reacting to
what?
So in that sense, it's kind of back reacting to the whole background as well. So that's sourcing the higher order coupling, right? The higher order correlation.
Of what?
With the curvature.
Right, exactly. So if you expand to linear order this coupling, it will have a linear order term which is proportional to delta phi, right? Delta phi is proportional to the curvature perturbation. So you will have a direct coupling, which is basically, and here you will have two powers of the magnetic field inside this field string, right? So you will have directly you can see from here that you will have some kind of three-point vertex where you have two magnetic fields and one delta phi, right, or one inflaton fluctuation.
And still it has the little effect on the power spectrum of the perturbation?
Right, because the magnetic field doesn't give a big contribution to the energy density of the background, right? So, uh, So the effect on the background fluctuations is small. It's just like a, So the effect will so the effect will come through a correlation function of this kind, okay? Where did we go? So the interesting thing that I will try to convince you is that you in fact get a very large BNL, okay? In the flattened shape. So in fact, and that's very interesting because even if the magnetic field gives a subdominant contribution to the power spectrum, it could in principle give the leading contribution to non-Gaussian energy, okay? Because it's so non-Gaussian. So well, to come back to your question, in some sense you could say that, well, I mentioned this upper bound on the strength of magnetic fields of order nano Gauss from CMB. So in some sense you could say that's exactly what you have because, I mean, okay, I mentioned to you that the magnetic fields will induce some kind of polarization in the CMB. And so from polarization from constraints of the polarization measurements in CMB, you have a constraint on the you have an upper limit on the strength of magnetic fields, okay, which is of order nano Gauss. So
I'm wondering how to physically interpret this. The local shape is easy to think about how this is happening because you've got basically a long wavelength perturbation in your inflaton, and that's sourcing a local variation of your magnetic field due to the coupling. But you're saying the squeeze shape is actually the really, really important one. That's a short wavelength perturbation in the inflaton. Does that mean that it's actually some kind of higher order coupling to the perturbation through the inflaton that's sourcing the squeeze limit?
Sorry, this is the flattened shape.
No, sorry, the flattened shape. It's a short wavelength perturbation of the inflaton is creating longer wavelength correlations with the magnetic field. What kind of mechanism should I have in mind for how that's
happening? You have a direct coupling between the magnetic field and the inflaton field, right? So you have an interaction vertex that that gives you that. So if you had very strong interactions, I mean, even in ordinary inflation, if the inflaton field had very strong self-interactions, you could also have very large non-Gaussian energy in ordinary slow-roll inflation, right? It's just the fact that slow roll inflation constrains you to have very weak self interactions because you need a flat potential. Okay. Now I'm introducing, if you want, a strong coupling between magnetic fields and the inflaton, right? That gives you large non-Gaussian energy.
I'm saying it seems like it would have to be. Is it a nonlinear coupling between the inflaton and the magnetic field? Because I'm thinking about if I have short wavelength perturbations in my inflaton field, I average over that to get the average magnetic field on a longer wavelength. I would think if it's just a linear, you know, three-point interaction, that I won't really see the underlying short wavelength perturbations in the inflaton. I'll get just an average magnetic field. But you're saying that's not the case. And somehow the magnetic field does just see the average value of phi on its wavelength. It's seeing short wavelength perturbations as well.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, in the squeeze limit, there is a very clear intuition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the mode of the curvature perturbation is long wavelength, the only effect it has is to rescale the background locally, and then you can use these causal arguments.
Absolutely.
When you have a short wavelength mode, I mean, you have to calculate it, right? I mean, you have to calculate the in-in correlation function.
That's what I'm asking. But the vertex you were saying was like an inflaton perturbation.
Right. So it depends on the coupling, obviously. Yeah.
So
let me go on. So I'm a bit sorry that not that you asked many questions because that's a good thing, but that I came a bit under time pressure here. So I have to be a bit quick on this. So let me try to review you this consistency relation. Okay. So idea is to do the same thing as we did before. And well, Okay, so then of course to get the correlation of the two powers of the magnetic field with the curvature perturbation, of course you need in the first instance to get this correlation function with the curvature perturbations and the vector potential, and then you can translate that into one with two powers of the b in the curvature perturbation. Okay, afterwards. So let's focus on this. Then in the squeeze limit where the momentum of the curvature perturbation goes to zero, okay, you can do the trick also that you also did for the Mendocino consistency relation. You can calculate the two-point function of the vector potential on the background of the long wavelength mode, and then correlate that two-point function with the long wavelength mode, okay? That will give you this correlation function and the squeeze limit, okay? So to do that, you notice that this field strength only feels the background through the coupling, okay? So if the coupling was trivial, this correlation function would be zero, okay? So you know that you can capture all the effect of the long wavelength mode by tailor expanding how the coupling depends on the inflaton perturbation, or the curvature perturbation. So basically, you tailor expand the coupling linearly in the curvature perturbation, okay? So you get a term that depends on how the coupling depends on the scale factor, okay? And then you get the variation of the coupling with the scale factor, which is just the curvature perturbation, okay? So then you define a pump field, okay? And then you define a Gaussian canonically normalized vector field, which is proportional to the Gaussian or the linear part of the vector potential times this pump field. Okay, so then you have your quadratic action before, where this is now some Gaussian canonically normalized vector potential. Okay, then you use that your two-point function in the background of the long wavelength mode can be written as the two-point function of the Gaussian canonically normalized vector field rescaled with the coupling. And then you expand the coupling in terms of the curvature perturbation, and you get how this two-point function in the background of the long wavelength mode varies with the curvature perturbation, okay? And then you correlate with the long wavelength mode, and you get a consistency relation for this correlation function with the curvature of the curvature perturbation with the vector field, okay? Two powers of the vector field. Where now the coefficient in front is the time dependence of the coupling, okay? That's it. So this is very nice, okay? Because this tells you that you have a magnetic consistency relation, and if you use the information about how the coupling varies with time, you have the consistency relation I mentioned before, where you can relate the time variation in the coupling to the spectrum of the magnetic field, and you have this, and you see that this BNL coefficient takes this form. Okay, so why is this interesting? Okay, so this is interesting in the same way as the usual consistency relation is interesting. If you observe that BNL is larger in the squeeze limit than -4. Then you know that this model is not the right model for magnetogenesis from inflation. Okay, so this is a way to rule out this model, just like FNL. To measure a large primordial FNL in single field slow roll inflation is a way to rule out single field slow roll inflation. Okay, so now you can go on. Sorry. So then you can go on and do the full in QFT calculation.
Could I just interrupt for a moment?
Right.
Sorry. I just wanted to say we're taking Martin to dinner at 6 o'clock in the bistro, so you're all invited if you want to join. Grad students, postdocs, eat free.
So I'm sorry to run a bit over time. So then you can do the full QFT calculation, and maybe I shouldn't go too much into the details of that, but you need the interaction Hamiltonian. The interaction Hamiltonian is you can calculate it from the ADM formalism. If you do that, you will find that naively you will get an interaction Hamiltonian, where the leading order term in the slow roll expansion is a total derivative. Okay, so some people have been working with this, and this can lead to this makes life more difficult for you, and can lead maybe to confusion even. Instead, if you do some partial integrations, you can eliminate the total derivative term and find a form for the interaction Hamiltonian, which is very simple, and where the leading order term in the slow roll expansion is not a total derivative. And you see that this leading order term exactly contains lambda dot once you have removed the total derivative. And I mean, this makes sense because we saw in the squeeze limit that the BNL parameter was proportional to lambda dot, right? So this makes totally sense. And then, of course, you can use this interaction Hamiltonian to compute the full thing, right? And this is what you get. The interesting part here is that you notice that there is a term which grows with the logarithm of time. So this is, I mean, this is not too surprising in the sense that the magnetic field is not necessarily conserved on supervised scales because it's just an isocurvature field. But this also means that this correlation function is enhanced when this growing log is the coefficient in front of this growing log is maximal, because of course that will give the maximal effect if you have 60 e-folds of inflation, say. And that is exactly flattened shape, and then you can just put in this condition for the flattened shape, that this momentum condition, okay, and then you get that this correlation function is becomes this. And if you use that the larger scales that we observe in the CMB exited to the horizon about 60 e-folds before the end of inflation, then you should put this log to be about 60, and then you get a very large BNL in the flattened shape, okay?
So this is not observable, right? Because you're looking at correlation of like the longest modes and the smallest modes that you don't really see.
You're looking at the correlation of the longest mode?
Oh, no, no, that's not true. They're all the same scales.
Right, up to a factor of two, right? So, and then you can, of course, check the squeeze limit result. And you find that in the squeeze limit, the integrals really simplifies a lot to this form. And they are related, the two integrals are related to each other. Okay, and you can, for integer values of n, you can solve this. And you find this in the squeeze limit, which exactly agrees with the magnetic consistency relation from before. Okay, so everything is in perfect harmony with itself. We are happy. And we can conclude that if the magnetic the consistency relation is violated, then we conclude the same as we could conclude if this ordinary Maldacena consistency would be violated in single field slow roll inflation, namely that then this this model is not a viable model. Okay, it's excluded. So it has a phenomenological strength in that sense. And also, the consistency relation is, of course, a very powerful theoretical tool for checking your the consistency of your calculations, because you know that they should agree in the squeeze limit with the consistency relation. And then, interestingly, in the flattened shape, the BNL parameter is extremely large. Okay, so the magnetic field fluctuations in the flattened shape are very non-Gaussian, and that is very interesting, because if we say that the magnetic fields are just on the verge of discovery in the CMB, so that means that they are just below below the threshold where they would leave an imprint of polarizations in the CMB, for instance, then their contribution to the curvature perturbations of the CMB would be subdominant. But even then, because they're so non-Gaussian, they could perhaps give the dominant non-Gaussian contribution in the CMB, okay? So, but this is something that needs to be explored, and we need to put the constraints on this parameter BNL, because it's so far, I don't think anyone has been trying to do that. Well, I think this is some interesting open problems that one can work on. I hope I didn't bore you too much. Some of you already left. Right. Thank you.